Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 1st, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, artificial photosynthesis brings practical fuel cells a step closer to reality. The discovery of the signaling pathway for certain kinds of pain, and China's environmental challenges on land, sea, and in the air. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
In natural photosynthesis, plants take energy from the sun and store it in the chemical bonds of glucose that the plant can metabolize later. In artificial photosynthesis, one goal has been to store the sun's energy by splitting water molecules, thereby rearranging water's chemical bonds into hydrogen and oxygen gases for later use in electricity-producing fuel cells. Scientists have known for a long time how to get hydrogen gas from water with catalysts such as platinum, but the problem has been how to get oxygen out of the water, too, in an efficient, inexpensive, and highly manufacturable way. Now, in a paper published online by Science, Daniel Nocera and Matthew Cannon describe such an abundant source, a catalyst that makes oxygen from water, providing the missing step needed to produce electricity through artificial photosynthesis in a closed system. I spoke with Nocera from his office at Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
Water plus light equals hydrogen plus oxygen, which is effectively stored as a chemical fuel. And in the blood and guts of this discovery, that is artificial photosynthesis, that equation. And now we can split water under the conditions of artificial photosynthesis, which is neutral water in air. So we have a way now to split water in a cheap, efficient, and highly manufacturable way outside of a leaf.
What had been the main obstacles in efficiently splitting water into hydrogen and oxygen?
It was this O2 side. So when you split water, it involves lots of electrons, 4 electrons and 4 protons in the chemical reaction. So in the splitting, there has to be a chemical rearrangement of the oxygen in the water to O2 and the protons in the water to hydrogen. And in that rearrangement of bonds of water, it was the rearrangement of oxygen that was causing all the problems. And that part, people couldn't do efficiently. There was no catalyst that did that well. And this paper has provided a compound that does that extremely well, this bond rearrangement of water to oxygen. The protons are left on the side, and then they're moved to another electrode where we make hydrogen. That we've known how to do for a long time, but we couldn't get the oxygen out.
And why in particular is O2 needed in this? We've always heard about the hydrogen economy.
Hydrogen, yep. So when I say I split water, it goes to hydrogen plus O2. And if you don't have the O2, then water becomes non-replenishable. You'll be feeding water in, and you'll only be making hydrogen.
And what normally then happens when you're just getting hydrogen out? Where does the oxygen
go? Oxygen, so if you just take H2 from water, you build up a bunch of hydroxide, and then you're going to have to get rid of that leftover hydroxide.
So by generating the O2 as well, you can turn that hydroxide back.
That's right.
So is the idea then to couple this to a photovoltaic and also couple it to a hydrogen-producing catalyst?
Right. So here's how you would think about it. You take water plus these catalysts and light from the photovoltaic, and you make hydrogen and oxygen. You store the hydrogen and oxygen. Then when you combine it back over, say, a fuel cell, you get water back and electricity out. So in this sort of design, you don't need to worry about where you're going to get the water from except the initial time. You get the initial water, then you're in a closed loop, and it's just humming away with light as an input from a photovoltaic. You're taking water to hydrogen and oxygen, and then hydrogen and oxygen back to water. If I don't have that O2, then you're stuck. You can't close the loop.
What is that compound then that is used?
The compound's really a simple one. So all you need to do, and this you really can do, you'll be doing in high school someday, and this will be easy for students to do because it is easy to implement. What we do is we take a piece of conducting material. In our case, we were using conducting glass, And then you make a solution up, and it has cobalt in it, cobalt ions, and it has phosphate ions. And then when you put the positive potential, so when you have a current, you have a positive part and a negative part. When you look on a battery, you always see that. If you take the positive side out and hook it up to this conducting glass, then the cobalt and phosphate form a thin film on the electrode, and that material is active for splitting water to O2. So it's really a thin film of a cobalt and phosphate on the electrode that do this.
Do you have to keep the material in that solution of cobalt and phosphate?
No. Once you make that electrode, you can take it out, and you don't need the cobalt anymore, but it's good to have the phosphate around. And the reason for that is, remember when we started, it was just a clean piece of glass, and then when we put the positive potential on it, it oxidizes cobalt. It takes it from what's called cobalt 2 plus to cobalt 3 plus. And the cobalt 3 plus and the phosphate form this thin film. Now, in the natural cycle of this catalyst working, it goes back to cobalt 2, and then it can redissolve. But then, when the electrode's under a positive potential, it goes back to cobalt 3, and then the phosphate in solution will capture it and bring it back to the electrode. And so we call that self-healing or a repair mechanism. So what you can do is make the catalyst out of cobalt and phosphate, get your thin film, it's like a darkish blue-black film on the conducting glass, take the conducting glass out and put it on a shelf. Then when you're ready to make O2, you can take that conducting glass, put it into a solution of phosphate, just phosphate in water now. Phosphate's a mineral, anion. And then the thing just hums away making O2. And the reason you want that phosphate is because in the natural cycle of the catalyst performance, the cobalt can redissolve in solution, and then the phosphate escorts it back to the electrode.
Now, phosphate and cobalt are fairly common. What about this conducting glass? That takes some manufacturing, doesn't it?
Yep. The conducting glass is, the one we're using is a little expensive. It's indium tin oxide, but that's not an important issue in our instance. We can use really inexpensive conducting glass. That's called fluorinated tin oxide versus indium tin oxide. It's the indium that makes it expensive. And the catalyst works well on that. We've been able to have the catalyst work on graphite. So it doesn't really care. As long as you can get positive charges to the surface of any conductor, this catalyst will form.
But you're still dependent upon platinum.
Right now, we're still dependent on platinum, the hydrogen-producing catalyst, but I am predicting that will go away in the next few months because we already have an alternative to platinum, and it looks like it's working pretty nicely in neutral water.
And that will be your next paper.
And that will be a next paper. Actually, our next paper would really probably be the full system design. There are catalysts that can take water to H2, but they haven't been implemented yet in neutral water because you couldn't get O2 out of neutral water. Now that we can, it's really a roadmap to how to get the hydrogen out.
Daniel Nocera, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
Daniel Nocera is senior author of a paper on making an oxygen-evolving catalyst. Read the paper at www.scienceexpress.org. In this week's Science, read two related papers, one on a different oxygen catalyst and another on operating a solid oxide fuel cell at near room temperature. Also this week, replacing motor neurons. In a paper published online, Kevin Egan and colleagues have generated induced pluripotent stem cells from skin samples of two elderly people with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, commonly referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease. The researchers then used these induced pluripotent stem cells to generate the motor neuron cells that die from the disease. The research shows that such induced pluripotent stem cells may indeed be generated from elderly people with a genetic disease, something that had not been done before. Ultimately, the hope is to use such genetically matched healthy cells to replace diseased ones. But for now, researchers hope to use the cells to better understand the disease process. Read more about it at www.scienceexpress.org.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
Pain is the body's mechanism for self-preservation, so it makes sense that the body's peripheral pain pathways may be activated by a range of stimuli, including being too hot or being squeezed too tightly. But this range of stimuli has made it very difficult to tease out how the body transmits the pain from, say, inflammation, as compared with the pain from heat. In a paper in this week's Science, John Wood and colleagues report the cell and molecular basis behind three types of pain, from noxious amounts of cold, inflammation, and pressure. The research may lead to analgesics that are better suited to treat pain, especially for those suffering from chronic pain. I spoke with Wood from his office at University College London.
One of the big issues in the pain field is the inadequate treatment of so many people that suffer chronic pain syndromes. And so the more we can find out about the signaling mechanisms, the more it helps us in the search for new analgesic drugs.
Why has it been difficult to ascribe types of pain to particular pain receptors?
One of the big problems is there's an enormous amount of redundancy in the periphery. So you'll find that if you have a tissue-damaging stimulus caused by heat or mechanical pain, that many different receptor systems are activated. And so it's been very hard to pin down a single, you know, supremely important peripheral transducing mechanism that is a critical element in pain perception. What we've done is to look at sets of cells rather than individual molecules, and in particular, cells that express particular types of channels that are responsible for electrical transmission. And by doing that, we've managed to home in on a subset of cells which express a variety of receptors, but which seem to be specialized for particular types of pain sensation.
Which channel in particular is this?
There's an ion channel that's associated particularly with damage-sensing neurons, and it's known as NAV1.8, which is a rather unmemorable name. But it's unusual and interesting because it's a channel that works in a potentiated way in the cold. And last year, Katharina Zimmermann at Harvard, in collaboration with Peter Rhee, showed that this channel is essential for feeling pain in the cold. So this channel seems to be associated with damage-sensing neurons and to have particular properties that are very important in pain pathways.
Now, you and colleagues in a previous paper had identified the importance of the expression of this same sodium channel. How have your current experiments built upon that previous work?
Well, NAV1.8 was originally cloned by Armin Akopian, a very brilliant molecular biologist who's now working in Texas in San Antonio. And we knocked the gene out to see what it did. We discovered that the heterozygous animals, animals with just one copy of the gene, were completely normal. And so we could use this particular gene to knock in an enzyme called Cre recombinase, which is an enzyme which allows you to specifically delete genes wherever it's expressed. So you can tag other genes with DNA sequences called LOXP sites. But if you flank the genes with LOXP sites in a transgenic mouse and then cross them with a mouse expressing the Cre recombinase at the NAV1.8 locus, then you can specifically delete genes just in the cells that express the sodium channel. And we know that this sodium channel is exquisitely, specifically expressed just in damage-sensing neurons and isn't anywhere else in the body.
And in this current paper, you and your team took further steps to eliminate the nerves expressing this sodium channel?
Yeah, we used this NAV1.8 Cre mouse to sort of unleash the activity of a diphtheria toxin subunit so that we would kill the cells in any of the neurons that normally express the sodium channel. And so in that way, we managed to wipe out all the NAV1.8 positive neurons. And this left us with animals which had very specific deficits, in particular pain modalities. And we went on then to use microarray technology to catalog all the genes that have been lost in those cells to give us a whole bunch of new candidate transducing molecules, which may be important in aspects of pain perception.
Were any of the neurons left expressing that sodium channel?
Well, we knocked out, I think we got rid of something like 96% of the transcript. So there may have been a few cells left, but pretty much we got rid of all of them, judging by our microarray analysis.
Is the next step then to find out at what point the number of cells with this particular channel expressed are significant or insignificant?
Yes. What we really want to home in on now are those pain modalities that are left in the mice which no longer express NAV1.8 positive neurons. And it turns out that the most problematic of pain conditions, that's so-called neuropathic pain, where nerves and cells are damaged, this form of pain still exists in these animals. So we're able to use them to look at candidate receptors and candidate sodium channels, which may be particularly important in transmitting information about this particular type of pain syndrome, which is the one that's most clinically difficult to deal with in man.
the neuropathic pain being causing sort of that pins and needles type of sensation.
Yeah, we found that pretty much all the inflammatory pain is lost, which is very interesting. So this is the kind of thing you would expect to get with rheumatic problems and so on. But the neuropathic pain, the kind of thing you would get with diabetic neuropathy or HIV-induced neuropathy, that still seems to be present. So we can conclude that the neurons that don't express NaV1.8 are probably particularly important in that type of pain.
So you were able to eliminate the pain of mechanical or pressure, cold, and inflammatory pain, but there's still neuropathic pain and heat pain left.
Yeah. There's been a lot of genetic analysis, particularly led by Jeff Mogul in Montreal at McGill, and they've provided evidence that heritability for mechanical and thermal pain are quite distinct, suggesting that there are different molecules and mechanisms that underlie these two types of sensation. And our work would very much support that view, that thermosensation seems to act in a rather different way from noxious mechanical sensation.
So with these mice that have this sodium channel blocked out, do you think you'll be able to further disambiguate between thermal and this neuropathic pain?
I hope so. I mean, one interesting observation that came out from a group led by Jeff Woods in Cambridge in 2006 was that people that don't have another sodium channel, NaV1.7, are pretty much pain-free. And they don't seem to feel noxious thermal pain either. So that would suggest that the NaV1.7 channel is particularly important, maybe in thermosensation. And so we'll focus our efforts on trying to understand whether NaV1.7 plays a particularly significant role in thermal pain and neuropathic pain in these animals where we've wiped out the 1.8 positive neurons.
How might this research lead to particular clinical applications?
Well, there are already subtype selective sodium channel blockers in clinical trials. Abbott Pharmaceuticals have been very active in this area, and they've managed to develop NaV1.8 channel blockers. And in animal models, these seem to be very useful in blocking inflammatory pain and to have some effects on neuropathic pain, although it's not clear how specific these blockers are. NaV1.7 is by far the most exciting new analgesic drug target because of the genetic studies in man. And I know that a number of drug companies are working very actively on developing blockers of this channel. We've done some collaborative studies with Pierre Escobas, who works in the south of France in Sophie Antipolis in Antibes, and he's found a tarantula toxin that blocks NaV1.7, and this toxin seems to be effective in all forms of neuropathic pain and inflammatory pain in animal models. So this is very heartening from the point of view of clinical treatment in man. I think these kind of experiments taken together all suggest that voltage-gated sodium channels are really very, very good targets for treating a variety of human pain conditions.
John Wood, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for phoning.
John Wood is senior author of a paper on the cell and molecular basis of mechanical, cold, and inflammatory pain. Read the paper in this week's Science. Also in this week's Science, the first stars. Naoki Yoshida and colleagues have developed a computer simulation that offers a detailed picture of how the first stars came into existence soon after the Big Bang. The results show that the primeval density fluctuations left over from the Big Bang can drive the formation of a tiny protostar with a mass 1% that of our Sun. The protostar then acts as a seed for the subsequent formation of a massive primordial star. Read the paper on protostar formation in the early universe in this week's Science. China's rapid growth has led to severe environmental problems in the land, sea, and air. From Beijing, Science's Asia News editor Richard Stone writes a package of stories in this week's Science detailing a few of China's many environmental problems, how they came about, and what the Chinese are doing to try to solve them.
This package of stories looks at the clash between China's rapid economic growth and environmental deterioration that results from such ambitious growth and the pressures of a population of more than a billion people. We have three facets of this very big story that we focused on land and sea and air. And we start the package with a look at the ecological consequences of the Three Gorges Dam, the world's biggest dam, which is coming into full operating capacity this coming winter. And it really has had a pretty astounding effect on the local environment.
I imagine that's going to allow the Chinese to generate lots of electricity and cut down on their burning of coal, as well as prevent some of the flooding that we've heard about in the Yangtze River's past.
That's correct. There are some significant benefits from the Three Gorges Dam. The electricity production is going to certainly contribute to the reduction in China's usage of coal. Certainly, China will continue to use coal as its primary source of energy for the next few decades, but the Three Gorges Dam helps just ease the growth in coal consumption. You also have the major justification for the dam is flood control. And periodic floods along the Yangtze, every 10 years there's major flooding on average, and then every century you have a massive flood. So the dam was originally conceived as a way to regulate water flow in the Yangtze Basin, which is home to 450 million people living along the length of the Yangtze. So it's a substantial benefit if you can reduce flood risk.
What have been some of the downsides then to the dam project?
Even from the beginning, when engineers started planning the dam, they knew that it was going to have a major impact on the environment. There was no question of that. From the very beginning, when they started the original feasibility studies of the dam back in the 1930s, they knew that it would transform the local environment. And the Chinese Academy of Sciences conducted an environmental impact assessment over 8 years, 1984 to 1992, where it was looking at all the consequences of the dam. And certainly some of the big consequences are the flooding of the reservoir as the Yangtze backs up behind the dam. It has flooded an area so far of more than 600 square kilometers. So more than a million people have had to be moved out of the way of the rising waters. One thing that's unanticipated until recently is the fact that the land around the reservoir, it's very hilly terrain, and there's been quite a few landslides caused by the destabilization of the slopes as the water's risen. So the destabilization of the land around Three Gorges means that they're going to have to relocate another 4 million people over the next 10 or 15 years. So that's a huge impact on people's lives.
Any problems downstream of the dam?
Downstream, you have water that passes through the dam tends to be relatively free of silt most of the year. So this is called a sour flow. And the sour flow downstream tends to erode banks much more than water with a normal load of silt. So you have the scouring effect. And that's a big problem, especially as the water reaches the Yangtze Delta, where over the course of centuries, pretty substantial islands have built up. And one island, Chongming Island, is huge. I mean, it has 650,000 people. So these islands depend on silt carried downstream. And so there's a concern that the sour flow that comes downstream from the dam may start to erode these islands.
What about the life in the river, the aquatic life, the fisheries, the people who depend on those fish?
Three Gorges Dam is certainly going to add to the woes that fishers are currently experiencing. There is quite a drastic decline in fish catch, and some ecologists are calling for a total ban on fishing on the Yangtze for the next 10 years to try to allow populations to rebound. The Three Gorges Dam is just one of many problems. Pollution has harmed fish, and overfishing and boat traffic. But what the Three Gorges Dam specifically has done, for example, one kind of fish in particular has suffered from the Three Gorges Dam, carp. It's because of the very subtle changes in the flow regime of the Yangtze introduced by the dam. It has affected carp spawning, and the numbers of carp eggs and carp larvae are just a tiny fraction of what they were prior to the completion of the dam in 2003. So it's a substantial reduction that's been directly linked to the dam. There are many other fantastic species on the Yangtze that are also suffering. The Three Gorges Dam could contribute to their problems, but the Three Gorges Dam itself is just one of many, I would say, villains in what is a pretty desperate situation for aquatic life on the Yangtze, and the other problems being pollution and overfishing primarily.
To the future of the dam, is this dam in a geologically stable area? We've all heard about the earthquakes recently in China.
Maybe, because the dam was sited where it is because it's in a relatively quiet seismic zone. It's a granite upwelling in a sea of relatively unstable limestone. This area is bounded by a couple faults, and the faults are not that far away. One is about 20 kilometers away, and the other is about 60. So you have the Three Gorges Dam itself in a relatively quiet section of crust, but seismologists right now are studying the structure of the faults next to this relatively quiet bit of crust, which the Three Gorges Dam sits on. And they're quite worried about whether there is a connection, a deeper connection between these faults. And that might imply that the Three Gorges area is not as seismically stable as the dam engineers had hoped.
The big fear being a dam breach.
Yeah, it's a relatively remote fear that there could be a catastrophic breach of the dam, perhaps from an unanticipated high magnitude earthquake for the region, or perhaps from spring flooding, from a massive surge of water from glacier melt that would overwhelm the dam structure. These are pretty remote possibilities, and I think a lot of people are fairly confident that the dam can withstand a reasonably big earthquake in a reasonably large surge of water upstream. But, of course, the fear that preys in the back of some minds is a very unexpectedly large earthquake or large surge of upstream flow.
What's the more likely scenario then for the future of this dam?
The more likely scenario is that as the world warms and the glaciers recede, there's a possibility some decades from now that the flow of the Yangtze will diminish so much that the whole point of having a dam for flood control and for power, it wouldn't serve those two purposes. And so you would essentially have this giant concrete monument to the profound transformation of a pretty large area.
That was Science's Asia News editor Richard Stone from Beijing on a package of environmental stories about China. In this week's Science, read more about the Three Gorges Dam, problems with Qinghai Lake, and the enormous effort Beijing officials are taking to clean up the city's air in time for the Olympics, which start next week. Finally today, Science News writer Rachel Zelkowitz is sitting in for David Grimm to talk about the latest science stories on Science Now. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, we've got something for everyone today. We'll be looking at how combination therapy is extending the lives of HIV patients. Secondly, an animal that actually uses alcohol as a food source. And finally, we'll take a look at how Mount Everest is actually helping you breathe.
Well, let's start then with a drug combination that's helping people live longer. Is this a drug cocktail?
This is for HIV, the virus that causes AIDS. And the study itself is actually more of a comprehensive study. It's not the discovery of a new cocktail. But what it is looking at data from other cocktails and how it's extended the lives of patients with HIV. And we've known that some of them are working to various levels, but no one had taken a look at the whole slew of data. And so finally, we have a study that shows that HIV AIDS cocktail drugs are actually helping people live as much as 43 years after being diagnosed with HIV.
Well, I'm sure since drugs were first introduced, they've improved along the way. Has that been part of the study too?
Absolutely. When the first anti-HIV drugs came out, patients would have to take as many as several dozen pills at multiple times during the day for the treatment to be effective. Now they can get by with just taking one, two, or three pills once a day. It's a huge improvement in the lives of HIV patients.
Well, is this something that a person infected with HIV would have to take for his or her life every day?
Yes, absolutely. They're saying in the industry that HIV is shifting from being a death sentence to now a life sentence. And it is possible to shift the paradigm and have it be more of a chronic disease rather than immediately life-threatening as it was in the 1980s and 90s. But it does require constant, vigilant management of the disease. So taking your pills every single day, not missing any treatment options.
Does it matter when you start treatment?
Well, that's another thing that they're looking to try to figure out, because it does make a difference how far HIV has progressed in your body as to when the appropriate time is to start the cocktail. And obviously, the sooner the better before it has time to really wreak havoc on your system.
Well, from doses of drugs to treat HIV infections to doses of alcohol as a food source. What's the source of this alcohol?
The source of this alcohol is actually a Bertam palm, which is a plant indigenous to Malaysia. And scientists found that there are at least 6 or 7 species of animals in the Malaysian jungle that use it as a food source. And what's really interesting about the plant is that it has the highest concentration of alcohol of any natural food. Concentrations that would put me under the table.
Higher than beer, then.
About equivalent to beer or wine. But what they found was that at least one animal called the pentailed tree shrew actually can consume the equivalent of 9 small glasses of wine and alcohol in a 12-hour period.
Have researchers figured out how the animal is able to cope with that alcohol, or does it end up just sort of moving around drunk all the time?
No, that was one of the interesting things about the findings. The pentailed tree shrews actually have to climb the Bertam palms to reach the flowers, which have the alcoholic nectar. And the researchers said they observed no problems moving for the animals, so no signs of inebriation. They don't know yet how the animals managed to process the alcohol, but they suspect it has to be a more efficient way than you and I would process that amount of alcohol. Because from an evolutionary standpoint, it doesn't make sense for an animal to be inebriated because that would make it much more easy for a predator to come along and snatch it up.
So the pentail tree shrew perhaps co-evolved with this particular palm
tree. That's
the
thought process. They definitely have observed that the animals feeding off of the nectar helped the plant pollinate. So they're trying to determine now what sort of advantage the pentailed tree shrew obtains from having that amount of alcohol in their system.
What implications, if any, does this have for human alcohol consumption?
Well, it does have some. I mean, clearly from a small pentailed tree shrew, which is a small rat-like creature, to a human being, there's clearly a great deal of difference. But if you go far enough back on the evolutionary tree, the pentailed tree shrew is actually very similar to the first primate. And scientists are saying that this shows that there is an original association between alcohol and primates, which is contrary to what people had thought before, saying that alcoholism and alcohol abuse is actually occurs because alcohol was introduced so recently in man's evolution that we haven't had time to evolve an appropriate response to it. This shows that, no, that's not true. Alcohol has been around for a very, very long time.
So would it be better then to use this rat-like creature, the tree shrew, as an alcoholic model rather than the rats that are currently being used?
Ideally, because it is naturally evolved to tolerate alcohol. However, you get into logistical problems. You can't always go to Malaysia to get a tree shrew for your alcoholism study. Lab rats are much more readily available.
Well, from the model of alcohol consumption in the lab to the model of how our atmosphere became rich in oxygen. What does Mount Everest have to do with how well we breathe?
A lot, actually. Researchers have determined that the same tectonic plate action that formed our mountains is actually what has caused the percentage of oxygen to increase from trace elements at the beginning of the planet's formation to the current 21% that we enjoy breathing today.
How so?
What they found is that when plates slammed together, they pushed up through the ground, and that's what's created our mountains. Over time, as wind and rain eroded the mountains, it brought minerals down to the seas, and that mineral became the food for tiny algae that were living there, who through photosynthesis created the oxygen that we know and love today.
Now the plates continue to move. Does this mean that over time that the oxygen percentage of our atmosphere will continue to increase?
Yes, the process is still ongoing, but it's a very, very slow process. For example, 40 million years ago, before the Himalayas formed, our oxygen levels were about 15% for the atmosphere. And over time, 40 million years worth of time, it's increased from 15% to 21%.
What are other researchers saying about this model of plate tectonics and its correlation with our percentage of oxygen in the atmosphere?
Well, so far, they've been very encouraged by the theory because they've been trying to determine where the oxygen came from. And this makes sense. They found correlations for 6 out of the 7 continents. And without this process, Earth may have had the same atmospheric conditions as Mars, which would not have been very conducive to life as we know it.
Okay. Well, thanks, Rachel.
Thank you.
So what other stories are you looking into for science now?
Well, we're looking into the genetics of schizophrenia and what exactly is causing it. And also a drug that seems to increase animals' ability to exercise for longer periods of time. So be sure to check out our website.
Science news writer Rachel Zelkowitz sitting in for David Grimm with stories from Science's free online daily news site, Science Now. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 1st, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.